This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, December 20th, 2011. I'm Caleb Brown. The president has backed away from a threatened veto of the Defense Authorization Act now that it's passed both houses of Congress, but not for the reasons you might think. There's plenty wrong with how the legislation deals with the subject of due process rights for Americans. Ben Friedman is a research fellow in defense and homeland security studies at the Cato Institute. We spoke last week.
I think the controversy about the that provision in the overall authorization bill from the Senate is a little bit misplaced because there is a waiver that lets the president not put suspected al-Qaeda terrorists and their associates in military detention, avoiding criminal trial if he so chooses. And I also think the way I read the law, at least, I think he could just avoid declaring them suspected al-Qaeda terrorists in the first place and say that's why we have trials and then avoid the bite of the law that way without even resorting to the waiver. So to me, the real problem with the bill is a different section. It's section 1031 of the bill, which sort of reauthorizes, arguably at least, reauthorizes the war. And it says that Congress affirms that the authority of the president to use all necessary and appropriate force pursuant to the authorization of military force includes the authority of the armed forces of the United States to detain covered persons. And then it says that that is a person who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks of September 11th, or those who harbored those people, and then also a person who was part of or substantially supported al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners, including any person who has committed a belligerent act. So that's a very broad definition of what the war we're fighting is. It's applied specifically to detention. But it's I think, dangerously broad. Dangerously broad because the Congress has not until now given such broad authority to the president to execute the war on terrorism. The authorization of military force passed prior to the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 limited the people targeted to al-Qaeda and those who harbored it, the Taliban. It said those who perpetrated September 11th and those who harbored them. So that, to me, means al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The president subsequently, Bush and Obama, have interpreted that as a very broad mandate to kill almost anyone that they deem to be associated with al-Qaeda or detain them. And their ability to do that has been limited slightly by the Supreme Court, which has done so by giving habeas rights to both Americans and non-Americans to challenge their detention by the military. But the courts have actually asked Congress to say what it thinks about these claims of authority by the president that have been made so broadly over this time. And this is the first time that Congress has really opined on the subject. And that matters, I think, because the way constitutional jurisprudence works in this country these days is that the president's powers are said to be at their highest when Congress has endorsed them. His constitutional powers get a boost from congressional endorsement. At least that's the way the law is interpreted most of the time. And so now, arguably, Congress has done that, and that means this might be cited in future cases where Americans are detained. The law does say the section of the Authorization Act does say this section should not be interpreted to enhance presidential war powers. And because of an amendment that Dianne Feinstein got added, it says and it shouldn't – it doesn't decide either way on whether the president can detain Americans on American soil. But I think that those sort of provisions in some ways go against common sense reading of what the rest of the bill says. And I think if you look at it broadly, the Congress is endorsing war powers that would allow him to do those things which the bill says it's not allowing. So it's a little bit complicated, but I think it is arguably a broad grant of discretion that hasn't before been given. And by the way, the House bill, the House Defense Authorization Bill, is worse. It just says we reauthorize the use of force against Al-Qaeda, its associated forces, the Taliban, and basically anyone the president thinks is associated with the war on terrorism. It's a very broad grant of authority, not just for detention. And that's whether or not we get the House language or the Senate language is going to be resolved in conference. But I think either way, it's going to be bad. And you know, it's totally unclear who an associated force of Al-Qaeda is. I mean, that's sort of basically like saying, you know, the president can detain anyone he wants. And not only that, but it's very unclear what Al-Qaeda even means these days. I mean, the meaning of that term has become very vague. You know, guys in chat rooms in Europe who sort of subscribe vaguely to that ideology, or even guys in chat rooms in the United States, are they Al-Qaeda? So it's a terrible, I think, a terrible statute. And I hope the president vetoes it. But if he does so, it will probably be for the wrong reasons.
Leaving aside the fight over you know, who has what power, whether it's the president or Congress, or whether or not this is a power to detain Americans is even a power that falls to them in this war on terror. But what of the policy itself, the detention policy itself versus trial in a U.S. courtroom for Americans?
I think as a general principle, even if war powers are legal or constitutional in their exercise, they ought to be minimized in a liberal or free society, because almost by definition, you know, detaining someone or killing them is about as contrary to liberal ideology as you can get. And why would you want to sort of maximize the use of those just because it's legal? It seems to me you ought to minimize it. And therefore, the burden ought to be on those people who think it's a good idea to use war powers broadly to explain why they're necessary in every case. And I think in this case, there's not a good case just from a pure security standpoint for using military detention as opposed to criminal trials. And the reason for that is because criminal trials, I think, produce better information about terrorism over time. So for example, the 9/11 Commission report, which is pretty good history and I think has some bad public policy recommendations, but the history is based largely on transcripts of trials that we had in the 1990s in the United States, criminal trials, federal criminal trials, which, as it turned out, revealed a lot of very useful information about the Al-Qaeda organization. That's one example. Another example is the case of the would-be underwear bomber, Mr. Abdul Muttalib, who was trying to blow up a flight over Detroit. He went to criminal trial, and he was interrogated by the FBI both before and after Miranda warning, and gave them a lot of information about terrorism in Yemen. And then he wound up pleading guilty on the first day of his trial. Had he not pled guilty, had the trial gone through and been litigated, the federal government was going to allege that the plot that Abdul Muttalib, the underwear bomber, was trying to execute was organized in part by Anwar al-Awlaki, the jihadist propagandist who the government says had graduated to being an organizer of terrorist plots. And we killed him with the drone strike, even though he's an American citizen, in Yemen a few months ago. And the administration has not told us what evidence they have to indicate that he was something more than a propagandist, that he was an actual terrorist organizer. So I think it would be good, it would have been good for us to hear in court why the government thought this gentleman was a terrorist, so we could understand what criteria they used to decide to kill American citizens overseas in the name of counterterrorism. So that's just an example where it's good for the taxpayer, for the citizen, in terms of the information we have about our government, to have a criminal trial. Trials are adversarial. Adversarial conversations tend to produce better information than one-way conversations, because the two sides are evaluating each other's claims. So I think that if you look at the record of criminal trials and terrorists in the United States, it's been a pretty good one in terms of convicting people and getting information, and there's no reason to abandon that system.
Ben Friedman is a research fellow in Defense and Homeland Security Studies at the Cato Institute. You can read more of his work at cato.org.